Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want hope through examples of improving life and the overall health of humanity. I'm your host, Eric, and today we have Jonathan Hunt Glassman. He's the CEO and co-founder of Or Health, and Dr. Joshua Lee, an associate professor in the Department of Population Health and Medicine at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York City. He's also the director of the NYU Fellowship in Addiction Medicine and chief of the Lee Lab at NYU. Or Health's mission is to provide people who are interested in learning how to cut back on drinking or quit with a means to work with their healthcare provider to obtain naltrexone prescription delivered to their home conveniently and discreetly. I wanted Joshua and Jonathan to join us because alcohol use disorder is a common problem for many Americans, but we sometimes forget about it, especially in light of the opioid epidemic and especially after COVID. And I'm interested in the idea of potentially cutting back, but perhaps to quitting as a health improvement strategy, when many would argue that it's an all or nothing kind of scenario, quit or stay an abuser. So Jonathan, Josh, welcome. Thanks a lot for coming. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about Or Health? Because I'm sure I missed something or just plain out didn't get it right. So go ahead and fill me in about how you got here.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. Or is a telehealth service that helps people get access to medication that's safe and effective for treating alcohol use disorder. We help both people who are looking to cut back and to quit. Josh can talk more about why we consider both of those to be legitimate goals of treatment. And the reason that we've focused on this is that, as you said, there are millions and millions, 29 million Americans who meet the diagnostic criteria for alcohol use disorder. Less than 10% get treatment of any sort. Less than 2% are prescribed one of the three safe, effective, FDA-approved medications for the condition. And we think using the tools of telemedicine, so the convenience of starting whenever you want, wherever you want, the privacy of doing it online from the comfort of your home, can be levers to help close that gap and help more people get access to treatment for what can be a quite devastating condition.
So what are those three medications? Just because so people can start to get the language and understand what they might want to talk about.
Yeah, I'll go. Thanks again for having us on. I'm Josh Lee. I treat patients for alcohol use disorder in person in New York City, and then through OR, you know, through this telehealth platform. We're using one medication, naltrexone, and the oral tablet once a day form of naltrexone. There are other forms of naltrexone, including a 30-day injectable, specialty medication that you need to get at a medical facility or a doctor's office. And there are other prescription medications like acamprosate and disulfiram that's used less often. But the two most familiar that you may have heard a family member was taking for a while or you've read about are naltrexone and acamprosate. There are a couple others that are not labeled in the United States by the FDA for alcohol treatment, but we think are probably okay or pretty good for the treatment of alcohol use disorder. They just have not had the studies and the kind of pharmaceutical marketing that gets you a label. Net, there's maybe five or six medications that you could think about using for alcohol use disorder. Okay. Most likely, you're going to wind up on oral naltrexone as the first stop. The bus kind of goes there for most people the most times. And we think most people in America with a drinking problem interested in a medication treatment, you're probably going to start with oral naltrexone. And that's really the basis for OR's product.
So let's lay some groundwork here. And you talked a little bit about it when you said 29 million Americans meet the diagnostic criteria for alcohol use disorder. Talk more about what are the guidelines? How do I know? How does one know? How does a provider know that someone might have an alcohol use disorder?
Yeah, I could probably speak to that too. There are screening questionnaires that are pretty well worked out. We've used them for decades and we think they're fairly reliable. You can use them in telephone-based surveys of the whole country, which is how we get numbers like that. And you can use them in the doctor's office to say, well, hey, you know, Eric, I should talk to you about alcohol as well as smoking and other healthy versus less healthy habits. The CDC and the federal kind of science guidelines say I should ask you once a year about your drinking. Do you drink? Do you drink at all, like ever? And depending on the answer, you go through a flow of like four or five questions, and you can get a pretty good sense of an alcohol use disorder diagnosis. You then need to do a longer interview that's a little more nuanced and give and take, and a little bit more like a kind of psychiatry interview for, do you really have bipolar depression? Well, that's not easy to answer in one or two questions. And then at the end of that, you come up with in the doctor's office or through ORS, kind of longer questionnaires when you go to our website and start using our app, you get a pretty firm sense of a kind of diagnosis. And it's based in part on how much you're drinking, and it's more in part on the problems you're having with alcohol and your kind of inability to change it or stop it, plus a desire usually to change it or stop it. So it's kind of that becomes the definition of most addictions, kind of unable to control or unable to stop despite harmful consequences. And you keep doing something, sometimes quite compulsively, other times just you do it regularly enough that you keep getting kind of bad things. And that usually we stop doing stuff that is hurting us, or we don't want bad consequences for our health, for our family, for our work. And if we keep doing it, that is like something really, you know, problematic as opposed to other things that we're able to kind of put aside when they cause problems. But that's how you get the survey results. When you call everyone up, you can do it pretty quickly and get a pretty good idea for how much people are drinking throughout the country and how many of those have real problems. And then in the doctor's office or through an app like OR, you do a few more questions and you get an even deeper understanding.
And help me with what appears like a funnel here for folks. And because a lot of times in the United States, we start with a number, you know, we start up with 29 million. And then am I part of that? What is one of my friends part of it? You know, how do people navigate through that? Because I think they want to go, is it five drinks? You know, I wake up in the morning, I go to work. And what you're talking about is the social impact of the drinking. Can you tell us how people ought to be thinking about navigating what you're saying versus this numbers theory of, well, if I have two glasses of wine, I'm good. People want numbers, but you're talking about real life impacts.
Well, you do some algebra, like how many drinks per week and how many days per week. And we do have kind of a national speed limit. It's about two drinks per day on average for an adult man, and it's about one drink a day on average for an adult woman or someone over the age of 65. So you can start there. Are you kind of above this? Are you speeding or are you not drinking or below that limit, kind of moderate drinker? And that's how these kind of algorithms, these questions start in the doctor's office. And then you can get into the problems. You know, well, are you having trouble sleeping, stomach pain, overweight, stuff that alcohol usually is not making better, making worse? Have people been talking to you in a negative way about your drinking? Have you had, you know, events, incidents, traumas that were related to alcohol? Have you been trying to cut down or quit and not been able to? When you're not drinking, are you kind of obsessing about the next drink or thinking about it a lot? And then if you're drinking every day at a heavy amount, do you have physical dependence where you might have withdrawal if you're not drinking and your tolerance has gone up and up and up kind of through the months and years? That's getting at like physical effects of alcohol and how you can become, again, physically dependent. And if you take away the alcohol, the body then has kind of a bad reaction. But mostly it's about kind of the, again, kind of social health and relationship part of your life and whether alcohol is negatively impacting that. But you can start with very simple stuff about how often you're drinking and how that compares to these national limits. That's a little bit more like blood pressure. Like, well, we took your blood pressure and the number is high and it's higher than we recommend. So let's work on that. That doesn't mean that you individually have to get your number back to a certain amount or can't be doing other stuff that makes you healthy. But we can say on average, you have high blood pressure, and that is fairly bulletproof in terms of what it predicts about risks going forward related to high blood pressure. The same can be done with how much you're drinking and how much you're drinking per day.
Eric, I think you kind of, you know, rightly hit on something that's really important, which is that this is nuanced and can be complex to navigate. And sometimes that can come as a bit of a surprise because we have somewhat of a culturally received notion that the world can be divided into two groups of people, quote unquote, alcoholics, which is a term that doctors like Josh don't really use anymore. And then on the other hand, people who are fine and have no problem with alcohol. The reason that this process of figuring out, do I have a problem? What are my options to address it is a little more nuanced is because the reality of alcohol use and misuse is more complicated than that black and white view. One of the things that a lot of our members at OAR will tell us and that I identify with to some degree is, you know, they'll say things like, I don't consider myself an alcoholic. I just see some of these negative consequences, or I see ways in which my life would be better if I drank less. And those are very legitimate reasons for seeking help from a professional like Josh that can help you navigate those nuances. No matter what label you do or don't put on it.
So what are some of those examples that you have run across? If someone's listening to this show and they're thinking about this, what are the kinds of things that you see consistently people tell you as, yeah, this is having a negative consequence?
Yeah, it falls into a few categories, you know, the ones that Josh outlined. So we see people who are experiencing physical health consequences. It's contributing to being overweight in a way that they find detrimental to their health. Certainly mental health consequences come up maybe more than one would expect. So contributing to anxiety or depression or other common mental health conditions. Problems with a spouse and you know, that can be, you know, very acute in, you know, fights with a spouse, or it can be more subtle. I've had a lot of parents of younger children who've been under a lot of stress the last few years saying, I wish I could be more present with my children instead of wanting to get them to bed so I can enjoy a glass of wine. Professional consequences. For me, my kind of, I call them more yellow flags than red flags, but they kind of spanned all of those categories. A fall, you know, down a flight of stairs, knowing that I wasn't fully creative and engaged at work, even though that might not have been evident, acting more wildly and inappropriately and in ways I regretted in social gatherings where I was drinking too much. And then that last piece is, you know, we talked about consequences, but there's also that piece of like, am I responding to those consequences the way I might to other negative consequences? And so that is an eye opener for a lot of our members too, is that feeling that like, I've tried, I've really tried. I've made a genuine effort. I'm doing everything I can on my own. And in that moment of truth, maybe it's at a happy hour after work where you've had one or two drinks and it feels so good that you lose control and end up having way more than you intended. That is also a sign that some help might be useful if we're unable to make those changes on our own.
Why don't people who probably see these red flags or yellow flags always go and subject themselves, and I'm using that word deliberately, to these questions from a doctor to get treatment, or even just go to AA?
Yeah, I'd go with they don't know. The doctor often misses that. If all your listeners think about the last time they were in a healthcare facility, did anything come up about smoking, alcohol, drug use? It's often second tier in terms of importance. We think like for adults and alcohol, it should be a once a year, you know, almost like an annual checkup, but it sometimes is and sometimes is not. And then can that health facility in your area, can your doctor or a number of doctors you see, nurses and PAs, physician assistants included, can they do anything about it? Like, do they feel engaged, skilled, trained, experienced? And once you say, you know, thanks for asking, no one's ever asked me that, I really am struggling with alcohol, can they do anything with that? And often the answer is no. Like, traditionally and historically in American medicine, we've ignored this problem. This was going back, you know, for the better part of the 20th century. We've not seen it as a medical issue. It's only recently that we're like, actually, your doctor should take responsibility and talk to you about this. And medical education, so whenever you went to med school, maybe hasn't caught up. Your training that you got in residency and your early career may have totally ignored this as well. And you may be sitting there as a mid-career physician and in Asheville or wherever, and really just still not really kind of know what to do. And that could go for smoking too, like an even more probably common health problem for someone to show up with. And can you walk them through nicotine replacement therapy, the different medications you can take, other resources for smoking cessation? The answer is still, in a lot of practices, no, not really. So the medical establishment or your medical system isn't really good at this yet and hasn't been in the past. I think it is improving, but that's, an opportunity for OR, for instance. We're trying to like just short circuit that. Like, you don't have to go to the doctor for this. You can just talk to us right now. We kind of are your doctor for this one problem, at least. We can get you the help overnight almost in terms of how we ship the medication, and you can try it. And it's there's no guarantee. And you may not like just dealing with an app versus a real doctor, but at least like you can very seamlessly, straightforwardly, try this quickly. And that we think would benefit, a lot more people. Anyway, so people aren't sure what to do. And then things like AA are actually quite, to some people, for those that it's worked, it's great, of course. And we generally tell everyone to think about trying it, but it's also quite scary to a lot of people. The thought of like walking into a room with other people or getting on a Zoom call, because a lot of it now is remote, but really, being present and in person and saying things like, I'm an alcoholic, or I have a drinking problem, or I've been addicted. Like they've never done that. That's been part of the struggle. And of course, a lot of shame, guilt, and regret builds up. And, all of us would probably be a little freaked out about walking into a group of people we don't know and talking about a really personal, problem or failure or regret that we have. And so that's one of the barriers, to say the least, of going to peer support. Even though it's anonymous, confidential, it's free. Those are all the great, parts about it. And generally people that have stuck with it really find that peer support incredibly valuable. But it's hard to get people to get in the door. And then maybe that'll be later, but we can do other things first. But if you're never going to have a kind of prescription or a conversation with the doctor geared towards, a solution, then you're just going to kind of be out in the wild struggling for years and years often.
Let's go through what someone can expect when they say, you know what? I do like the idea of this discreet. I don't have to go to see my provider. I don't have that awkward feeling of how many drinks do I have? And do I want to give the full amount? There's this stigma that comes with it that they don't want to go through. So let's talk about the end-to-end. When someone makes a decision to call you guys, what's the experience going to be?
It all starts at orhealth.com, O-A-R health.com. We have a lot of information there for those who are interested, but still want to learn more, since this option of medication-assisted treatment, and in some instances, even the diagnosis of alcohol use disorder, can be new topics. So a lot of content and information. People can set up 15 minutes to chat with me, kind of like we're chatting right now. And then when they're ready to get started consulting with a doctor or nurse practitioner who's licensed in their state, they can click on one of the big get started buttons. And that triggers one of those questionnaires that Josh described to gather some initial information on a few topics. First, patterns of drinking and the consequences it may be causing in one's life. Second, a more general medical history and medication list so that the clinician can have context for the treatment plan they'll be putting together. And third, folks do need to upload a copy of their driver's license and a selfie so that we can verify we're treating who we think we're treating. That all gets collected up and routed to a doctor or a nurse practitioner who's licensed in the state of the person who's using the service. The doctor or nurse practitioner may have some additional questions, kind of probe deeper on some of those topics, certainly evaluate any contraindications to using medication, although there are not too many when it comes to naltrexone. And that's all in service of the doctor or the nurse practitioner putting together a treatment plan. That treatment plan typically includes recommendations for psychosocial support that are in line with the patient's preferences and interests. So AA would be one example of that, but far from the only example that falls into that psychosocial support category. And then in instances where medication is clinically appropriate and the patient has an interest in it, all of the providers on the OAR platform can write a prescription for naltrexone, that frontline or first bus stop medication that is the best fit for most people for AUD. The member at that point then has the option to have their prescription sent to a local pharmacy or to get delivery from OAR's partner pharmacy. A lot of folks do opt for that second option due to the convenience and the privacy and discretion of the way we ship the medication. They opt for that. It's usually in their mailbox within a few days, and they can get started. Coming back to OAR to check in with their clinician if they have any questions. When do I take it? Side effects? Am I making the progress I intended? Do I need to change dosage? So it's intended to be kind of end-to-end for medication-assisted treatment with naltrexone.
What states? In all states or just some states?
We're in 41, so serving the vast majority of the U.S. population, including North Carolina.
Okay, great. Now, what if I just want the naltrexone? Hey, doc, I'm drinking too much. It's bothering me. I don't need the psychosocial, you know, how we've become in America. Just give me the prescription. What would you say to folks, and how do you manage that?
You want to take a crack at that one, Josh?
We say great. We say awesome. Like it should, you know, it is, think of it like hypertension. My friend, your blood pressure is too high. You can lose 40 pounds and start exercising 4 times a day. You can stop smoking and you can stay away from salty junk, fast food. Do all that, come back in 3 months, and if your blood pressure is still high, we need to talk about medication. Most Americans, that's probably a typical case of like a 58-year-old being diagnosed with hypertension in America, they will come back with elevated blood pressure. They have not been able to wave a magic wand, lose 40 pounds, change their entire kind of lifestyle, change their income bracket in terms of what food's accessible to them, and change their culture in terms of what food they eat, and stop smoking. So that none of that was getting us far enough, quick enough. And by the way, your dad died of a heart attack when he was your age. So it's really time to do something right now about your blood pressure, which is too high. And so here's a medication, and we're going to watch that medication, do some testing to make sure you're handling it okay. Hopefully it lowers your blood pressure. There might be a second medication after that. This is very common. None of us would be surprised by how we're treating our blood pressure. And, you know, something like high blood pressure is going to be a risk factor in sudden and eventual death, premature death of usually from cardiovascular reasons for a huge swath of all of us. You know, it's just one of the leading killers in America. And we don't bat an eye about, I just want a medication and I just need to take my meds. And I have not been able to lose all that weight. And I still like to eat, you know, chips in the car, but at least my blood pressure is down and my risk of a sudden heart attack is much lower today than it was 6 months ago when I started this journey. Same thing here for alcohol and medications. We're not embarrassed. We're not ashamed. You want to take a pill for this? You want to just try and keep it to a pill and see if that works for you? We totally support that. Often people find that's not quite enough. Like I've took the pill, it worked for a while. I kind of stopped taking it. I went back to drinking about how I was. Or I took your pill, I felt some effects, but I wish it had done even more for me. And then you got to think of other things we can do. Should we raise the dose of the pill? Should we add a second pill? Is it not going to be enough in your case? And do you need more psychosocial support, more individual counseling, a real brick and mortar drug and alcohol kind of program near you? That's absolutely, you know, possible. The pill just isn't going to be enough, but it's certainly worth a first try. And there's nothing wrong with doing it. And if we did that at scale throughout the country, again, using this hypertension example, we would just help a ton more people, because you will discover that a fair amount of the pie can just take a pill and do pretty well with that and use it to their advantage, use it long enough to make real changes in their drinking, stay on it even longer to kind of cement that and not go back, or they might use it periodically. That's not unusual. Sometimes, like some of us have bounced around on other maintenance medications that we actually don't take every day for 6 years, but we're on and off like an antidepressant, kind of when symptoms are under control and then for a period after that, and then we try and ease off and up, something came back, and then I'm going to go back on an antidepressant. Alcohol medications can be used in a, you know, a couple different trajectories and ways, but it's absolutely 100% evidence-based. And we think, you know, pro public health to say, just try this medication. We don't have to make it a whole dramatic intervention. Your family doesn't have to show up and take you to rehab. Just start this medication and then let's see how it goes. Kind of let's do a trial.
Alcoholics Anonymous has a long history. And I think there are folks who are really passionate about that when it works. And they might argue, you can't just give someone a pill. There's more to it. You've got to stick with the program and do the work and do all those things. What would you say to that, those folks who maybe have been through it or who would be advocating for AA as an alternative to this?
I would say we love AA. Jonathan, I don't know if you have any other official or statements on that. Like, it's awesome. The problem is not enough people ever go, and those who go, the max they ever go is once. So it doesn't, much like saying, just take a pill, that's all you got to do, that's not going to work for everyone. It may not even work for the majority of people to try that the first time. The same thing can be said of AA. It doesn't stick with enough of us. Enough of us don't try it initially. And so you kind of need all those things in the possible solution toolkit, but it's hard to predict who's going to stick with this one or that one. And there's no problem kind of letting people try it in sequence or try it all at once and recommending them kind of universally for everyone, knowing that not everybody's going to be grooving with AA.
Right.
And then AA, the model of AA is long-term in-person peer-to-peer relationships. And that obviously through COVID kind of got scrambled with a, do you want to do AA Zoom? Like, you know, is that quite as good as what you were hoping for? It may be, it may not be. So we're also like trying to adapt to, you know, where we are now culturally and in terms of communications and in-person versus remote. And that has, you know, big effects on AA and less effects on like, just take a pill at home.
Josh comes at this, you know, as a student and scholar of population health. I came at this originally more as an N of one, which is not as good from an evidentiary perspective, but hopefully exemplifies some of the findings that the broader research indicates. You know, it was no secret to me over 15 years of misusing alcohol that I had a drinking problem. And so I tried a lot of different options, starting with the most well-known, Alcoholics Anonymous, of which I too am a huge fan and, you know, recognize that it has helped millions of people, probably millions more than the rest of us put together. So we should be fans of it. But I was an example of someone that it just didn't click with. It was some of the first principles, you know, admitting powerlessness over alcohol wasn't really what I was looking for. I was looking more for control over alcohol rather than vice versa. Higher power didn't resonate with me and my background, and getting myself to a meeting every day at the beginning didn't feel consistent with the rest of my life. Doesn't mean that I didn't get some good things out of those meetings. But you know, the turning point for me was much more a physician who accepted my goal of moderation and suggested prescription medication as an easy first step. And I think that's reflective of a broader principle, which is we have numerous evidence-based options to treat alcohol use disorder. It's hard to predict which one or which combination is going to be the best fit for any individual. So I would encourage anyone who's, you know, trying to drink less or quit to do a little bit of research on what those options are, and then trust their instincts on which are going to resonate with them, which are going to unlock their strengths, their capabilities, the ways in which they've solved other hard problems in their life, and then not be afraid of trialing and or combining and layering on. We have a lot of members who are doing AA plus medication through OR.
So, hey, Jonathan, you brought up something which I also noticed, I think I saw on your website, let's just say someone's listening and says, well, I don't really want to quit. I know I need to dial back, but honestly, I think what I really need is to maybe just slow down. Is that possible, or is this an all or nothing proposition?
This is another topic that we're not embarrassed or ashamed about our position on, which is we think both moderation and sobriety are fantastic goals. And in fact, the majority of the folks who have started with OR begin with a goal of moderating rather than quitting entirely. And so maybe I'll let Josh talk a little bit about why we think the evidence supports at least an openness to moderation as a goal.
Yeah, in terms of like the daily and then long-term toxicity from alcohol metabolically in your body, cancer risk, heart disease risk, risk of trauma, accidents, et cetera, it probably is fairly linear in that the less you drink, the less risk you have. And it's not unlike weight loss or back to hypertension. You may not get to your weight loss goal, but any amount of weight loss is probably improving your overall health and your chance of kind of better health outcomes. So I want to lose 20 pounds. I lost 18 pounds. That's like awesome, right? You didn't quite get to 20. You didn't quite get to, I'm not drinking at all ever on the weekends again. Okay. I occasionally, you know, do still have drinks at dinner, but we think that that kind of like turning down the volume is, as long as you're moving in the right direction, that's probably good for you, probably good for all the other stuff you care about, and it's worth celebrating and supporting. The risk, I guess, in traditional alcohol treatment, the teaching would be that, okay, but a lot of people can't handle that, can't do it. They will find that the goal of moderation sounds good, but it really is just what's happening is kind of the pattern is not really breaking, and moderate drinking really is just kind of continued heavy drinking, if let's say that's what the person was trying to change. And then that person has to, hopefully with the support of their treatment team or the OR treatment team or in a real doctor's office, get some feedback that they're kind of in about the same place they were when they started. So maybe a more kind of dramatic change and a kind of commitment to like not drinking at all for a period of time. Is the next step, as opposed to let's just try and only drink on the weekends and I won't drink during the week. And that didn't work out. So let's try and let's say no drinking for 30 days. Let's see if we can do that and then come back and it may not work. And let's troubleshoot, you know, what was kind of the dynamic that month. And slowly but surely, you kind of try and find a new equilibrium where people are making, you know, good strides, good progress. It doesn't have to be the holy grail of perfect health for the rest of their life and no drinking ever again. And then it lets you not focus on this, like, what? I can't ever drink again. You're telling me that, like, my best friend is, I have to, like, kill that person? Like, because my best friend is, you know, my drinking and I really do like things about it. And I would be really crushed if I could never hang out with that person again. And you can say, well, that's not what we're talking about here. This is not like a forever kind of thing. And you can drink sometime into the future. But like what's happening now is, you know, that relationship is pretty toxic and we need to like totally take a break, or we really need to, you know, ease off and come up with like more strict guidelines. And then you just see if that's working, and it may or may not. And that is alcohol treatment, that kind of back and forth, working with more or less support, with medications, without it, in groups, not in as many groups, different types of groups, bringing in your family as part of it versus not. Those are all the give and takes in traditional alcohol treatment that are going to play out over years in some cases, or take a few months to figure out in many.
Okay, so now I'm really comfortable. It's discreet. It's safe. I can go online. What's the relationship between OR and the clinical folks there and the program you guys use and, you know, in person, face to face? How do they work together? Don't they work together? What should folks expect if they were going to start with the naltrexone?
This time, OR does not provide in-person services. We're really focused on increased access to naltrexone from an expert empathetic clinician that can help you make the right decisions about how long to stay on the medication, how to manage side effects, changes in dosages, things of that nature. And so you can kind of think of it as an online version of you go to your primary care physician who to address kind of a complex medical and behavioral health condition. The clinician can write a prescription for a medication that may be very helpful. For some, that's all they need. They're off and running. For others, they need more layers of support, as you said. Typically, what we're going to be, what the clinicians at Aura are going to be doing is making referrals and recommendations for that in-person support. We have a lot of confidence in our members' ability to be experts on themselves and to assemble that right fit of tools and supports, maybe very low intensity, maybe higher intensity, may change over time. And our clinicians' role is to kind of offer a menu of helpful options.
So what do I get? Do I get 6 months, a trial, a year? Is there a higher dosage because things aren't quite working out? Do I check in and say, look, I'm still experiencing these things? And then one of your clinicians says, well, you should really try, you know, AA, for example. What should I expect over a year between naltrexone and kind of you guiding me, referring, as you said, to other options?
People can receive the naltrexone in either in a 90-day, 180-day, or 360-day quantity based on their preferences. In terms of kind of ongoing check-in over, let's say, that first year, most important thing to know is that members can check in with their care team at any time. So, it's as simple as logging in and sending a message. There's not the need to schedule an appointment, which, as we know, can unfortunately take weeks in some doctors' offices. Over the course, and then there are a few points along the way where we will suggest a check-in just based on time passing, but we do leave a lot of discretion to the member in terms of what are those moments that matter most when they need support. We see more, questions and desires for initial support at the beginning, as you'd expect. And then folks coming back at say 3, 6, 9, 12 month intervals roughly to do kind of a health check or a status check. And, Josh, maybe you could talk about kind of some of the good topics for those check-ins.
Yeah, happy to. One is, how's your overall health? We do have to prescribe this safely. Usually there's not a lot of fanfare, but that can also dovetail with like any side effects to the medication. All these medications that we just talked about, acamprosate, naltrexone, others, have potential side effects. They're generally well tolerated and you get used to it. For instance, naltrexone can cause a little bit of, especially the oral tablet, mild upset stomach the first time you ever take it, but that generally goes away and you tolerate it. But we'll spend a little bit of the early months sometimes on those issues, just like kind of medication taking and tolerating the medication. The doses can go up. We could generally double the dose of naltrexone. We start with 50 milligrams. The biggest trial ever in the United States that showed naltrexone plus just kind of seeing the prescriber and getting basic what we call medical management counseling is about the best thing you can do for alcohol right off the bat. That's one of the basis for what we're doing here. That trial used 100 milligrams of naltrexone in part because most people, when you prescribe a once-a-day medication, they don't actually take it every day from then on, just like you told them to. There's a lot of missing and skipping and delaying and, I ran out, but I haven't gotten the refill yet. That's pretty natural. So doubling the dose can help with that. So the days you do take it, you're kind of taking about 2 days worth. And then just feedback, I think, on how you're doing. And then if people are doing great and they're like, this was a miracle, and you can get, these are not made up anecdotes. Like people will say, this has been a total game changer and I'm so much better off now. And it's 6 months later. So now we're talking about, do we kind of maintain? Can you take a break from those are, stuff we have less guidance on in terms of like what the evidence shows or what exactly we should do. But we want to work with people on those questions too.
So how fast does this work? How quickly should someone expect to get results from naltrexone?
Yeah, right away. It's a medication that is absorbed in terms of the oral one, you know, through your stomach and intestines, and it gets in your blood, and it gets a little bit of processing in the liver, and then it goes to your brain, and it crosses the what we call the blood-brain barrier, and now it's sitting on your opiate receptor. Now, Trexone, importantly, is a opiate receptor blocker in our brain. We have opiate receptors throughout the body, but the most important part we're talking about is in the brain. We use it for the treatment of opiate use disorder. So after you've detoxed, can we kind of put a light socket cover or a manhole cover, if you will, a lock on the opiate receptor? And then other molecules like oxycodone, heroin, fentanyl can't get in there. And it turns out if we also block the opiate receptor, alcohol can't really push that same button. And in many of us, we like drinking in part because this is kind of a parable here, because it's a little like an opiate. It can hit and stimulate our opiate kind of mechanisms in our brain. And we can interpret that as really good, enjoyable, relaxing, a fun kind of high. And that is similar to the mechanism of opiates. So alcohol, in a sense, is like a little mini opiate, and that can be the basis of some of our, not everyone's, but a lot of people's kind of enjoyment and then kind of repetitive use of alcohol. So you block the opiate receptor, and you don't get as much out of that next drink. You don't get as much out of alcohol in general when you're not using, you're not thinking about it as much. You kind of really kind of just turn the brain 90 degrees to the right, and you're just kind of ignoring a lot of what you used to kind of feel minute to minute or hour to hour regarding alcohol. That's the magic of naltrexone. It can really kind of turn your brain into a, I'm not that interested in alcohol. Why would I have a drink tonight? I'm like, I don't even feel like that. And that is like that for some people, that can be an overnight change from how they were the day before, which is like, I always drink at night and I'm about to drink now. And like, that's how I have dinner, you know, and that's kind of a miracle and blows people's minds, if you will. But it doesn't happen that way for everyone. It is not a 100% solution that you can guarantee or anything like that. It just works for more people than the other medication, and it works for more people than placebo or doing nothing and not taking a medication. So that's why we say it's effective and evidence-based. But we also don't want to like blow smoke and sell snake oil. This is not a cure for everybody overnight. All you got to do is try it, and then, you know, you'll be healthy the rest of your life. That's not it at all. You really got to see if it's going to work for you, and then take it from there.
So speaking of if it's going to work for you,
yeah,
you know, people, a lot of pharmaceuticals have side effects. So there's this feeling of, yeah, it's helped me with problem A, but now I've got these other problems. So things like you talked about, alcohol can have a negative effect on work. It can have a negative effect on relationships. It can have a negative effect on friendships when you are drinking and you, let's say you get argumentative or you do something crazy. So you're giving these things up because you're taking naltrexone. Great. Are there side effects that are going to be negative that people should think about?
Generally not long-term, and in the sense of like, well, yes, but it could cause kidney failure or it could give you stomach cancer. None of that is the case with naltrexone. It's a pretty safe, well-tolerated long-term medication. The side effects we worry about are generally about tolerability. And if it's going to like give you upset stomach or it can cause a little headachey, flu-like symptoms, some people just won't ever tolerate it in terms of like, this antibiotic upsets my stomach. I just cannot take clindamycin. To use another example, that does happen with some of our commonly prescribed medications. And naltrexone, you would have these side effects up front, and you really wouldn't like the medication because of the side effects. And we would move on. Like naltrexone probably at that point would not be for you. But long term, no, it doesn't. You're not doing some trade off where you don't drink anymore, and that's great, but you're going to get dementia or, you know, cause the risk of some other disease to go up. That's not the case at all. The side effects that you don't expect. It's also a labeled drug for weight loss. People can find they just don't, much like alcohol can kind of feel like binging. It's kind of a treat that you can overdo it on, like donuts or other kind of overeating. It's a lot of calories, obviously, getting back to like the weight thing. And it can help people lose some weight. People also might find they don't like cigarettes as much if they're drinking and smoking. And then, of course, it's going to block your opiate receptor. So it could be dual treatment if you had an opiate and alcohol problem. But it's going to pretty much guarantee if you're on it, you don't have an opiate problem because you can't be taking opiates while on naltrexone.
Okay, so let's go through this again. Jonathan, walk us through where I go, what I'm going to do next, and tell us one more time about how this all works.
Sure. So if you are someone who is looking to drink less or to quit and think that medication might be a useful tool in your toolkit, that's what orhealth.com exists for. So step one, go to orhealth.com. Step two, click on Get Started, and we'll take it from there. It's a pretty intuitive, easy to use interface that will allow you to connect with a licensed, trained clinician who can prepare a treatment plan for you, and if medically appropriate, prescribe naltrexone, which we can deliver to your door within a few days.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about privacy. Are there any risks there for folks?
Yes, we take privacy and the security of our members and users' data extremely seriously and take extensive efforts to protect the private, sensitive medical information that they are sharing with us in order to get treatment. We're certified by LegitScript, which is the leading authority on these matters for telemedicine businesses. And in fact, privacy is one of the reasons that at least some of our members seek us out. You know, I think of one in particular who said she knew personally every doctor and pharmacist in her rural community and really didn't want to get into this topic with them. And that's a little bit of an extreme example, but I think representative of one of the valid concerns that people have that has driven kind of the adoption of OR and other sorts of telehealth solutions.
We're going to have to run, but honestly, I think that this sounds like a great solution for folks. I think what you're doing is great because there's probably a lot of people out there who feel like, I think that stigma of approaching, going to the AA meeting, even the convenience are two factors which you guys are helping to overcome. So Jonathan, Josh, thank you very much for coming. Join us next week for another exciting episode of Solutions for the Underaffiliated. And remember to check out all of our podcasts of this show at underaffiliated.com. Thanks a lot, everybody. Have a great day.